Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio. Welcome to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you, as always, for tuning in. What are your favorite children's books? I'm a Roald Dahl, scary stories to tell in the dark kind of guy myself. What about you, man?
Yeah, Noel is my name, and I, too, was a Roald Dahl fan. I ate that stuff up. It sounds cliche, but those really were the books that kind of taught me how to love to read. Because he's such a... I don't know, what do you call it, like a fabulous, like his stories just have so many great characters and they always go somewhere interesting and there's like a morality tale kind of, but it's not too heavy handed. And I don't know, it's a little trippy and there's darkness and there's stakes. You know what I mean? I loved Roald Dahl so much.
Oh, yep. That's right. I forgot. I'm Ben Bolin. I still have a name in the times of quarantine. And I am with you there, Noel. One thing that I thought was so interesting as a kid is that I always, for years, thought Roald Dahl's name was misspelled. It was a typo. I thought it was Ronald Dahl, and that it was missing. But there is this great darkness to his work. Shout out to George's Marvelous Medicine, I believe is the title. The entire story is about this kid who has to give his grandmother medicine while his parents are away at the market or something for a day. And the whole book is about how he plans to kill her through poison. It is fantastic. I reread it, still holds up.
Yeah, I mean, The Witches is genuinely terrifying. But we're not talking about Roald Dahl today. We already did that episode. Remember when he was like a badass fighter pilot and possibly the real life guy that James Bond was based on? Because he definitely hung out with Ian Fleming. That's a really good one from the back catalog, folks. If you haven't heard that one, I definitely would check it out. Today we're talking about a markedly less dark beloved piece of children's literature about a monkey and a man in a yellow hat.
Yes, an inquisitive man, an inquisitive monkey, and a tolerant authoritarian. How about that? Before we begin, shout out, of course, our super producer, Casey Pegram. Still rocking that retro Windows background. How you doing, Case?
I'm just loving this green field and blue sky, you know? There's nothing better. So I'm just gonna roll with it.
Is there like vaporwave music playing on repeat, just like dripping from the clouds and coming up from the green grass?
Absolutely. It's quite a thing. You guys will have to experience it firsthand.
Yeah, it looks pretty trippy, my friend.
Yeah, there better be some vaporwave going on over there. Yes, this is a story about Curious George, about the creators of Curious George. Now, as you said, Noel, that's an inquisitive little primate. Now he is famous, especially in the West. He's known the world over. He was the brainchild of a Jewish-German couple named Hans and Margaret Ray.
That's right. Hans and Margaret Ray, Hans being the illustrator and Margaret being the writer, lived in Rio de Janeiro in the 1930s. And there they had two pet monkeys. And those pet monkeys became the inspiration for a character they created named Fifi, who is described in a lovely Mental Floss article as an impish, inquisitive monkey. I love impish. I also like puckish. But they eventually moved to Paris when the Nazis were occupying France, and they were forced to flee for their lives, carrying with them the manuscripts for the story that we now know and love, and we couldn't picture a world without Curious George, tucked under their arms and escaping for freedom. This is the story of how that story, Curious George, came to be and kind of morphed from their original concept, and how the Rays made that intensely dangerous and brave escape from Nazi-occupied France.
Yes, yeah. And we're going to start with some background. Let's start in lighter times, right? Less heavy-hearted times. Hans Augusto Rey was born in September in 1898 in Hamburg, Germany. He grew up, by the way, near the Hagenbeck Zoo, and this gave him two lifelong loves. Loved animals, and he loved drawing. The woman who would become his wife, Margaret Elizabeth Waldstein, was born in Hamburg in 1906. This is a neat little rom-com moment for them because they met just briefly when Margaret was a young girl before she left Hamburg to study art. And they have one of those beautiful relationships where they can remember all the significant moments. So he remembers first seeing her at a party at her dad's house in Germany. She was sliding down the banister. So fast forward a little bit, Hans moves in 1924. That's where he ends up in Brazil, in Rio de Janeiro, after he served in World War I. He was sketching, he was painting, he was also, he was a roving plumbing fixtures salesman. He was going, this is so weird. It sounds like something from a Kurt Vonnegut or Donald Barthelme story. He was riding up and down the Amazon selling plumbing fixtures as part of his family business.
I miss the old days of the traveling salesman, don't you, Ben? Feels like a bygone era, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Did you guys ever see that documentary about the Globesman?
No.
It's this documentary about these guys who, I can't remember if I'm thinking of the documentary version or the mockumentary version with Fred Armisen, but there's some great documentaries and mockumentaries out there about the harrowing life of traveling salesmen. It's often not a very glamorous life, even in the heyday. But check out Documentary Now if you haven't seen it. It's fantastic. Have you guys seen that? It seems like you would have seen
it. I've seen multiple episodes. I just haven't seen that one. My favorite one is the one that makes fun of Stephen Sondheim, the musical one. Mm-hmm. That's like in the 70s, and they're like, you know, just feverishly smoking cigarettes like in the studio and making these kind of very baroque and rapid-fire lyric kind of like Broadway-type pieces with his name, John Mulaney, playing like the Stephen Sondheim type character. It's wonderful.
Yeah. So, to the point, he's living this salesman life for about 10 years.
Right. But then in 1935, in Rio de Janeiro, Hans had moved there and was selling bathtubs now. And Margaret was making her first escape from the just awful situation in Germany, where she was obviously very unsafe and needed to flee. She convinced Hans to get out of the family bathtub selling business, and they started to join forces on some creative projects together. They actually opened an advertising agency, which there hadn't been one up to that point in Rio de Janeiro. And that is, you know, I always think of this era of like Mad Men, like those really beautiful illustrated advertisement posters, kind of, you know, and that's the kind of work that Hans did. That was how you made money as an artist in those days. And that was kind of how he got his start. And Margaret wrote the ad copy. So they were kind of a dynamic duo from the start.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And they married that same year. They reunited August 16th, 1935. All of the contemporary accounts of them are very kind. They had a very nice, affectionate relationship. And people unanimously agreed that they were a very well-matched couple. It's funny because, you know, picture, dear listeners, the face of Curious George in your head. There are people who were friends with them at the time who will swear up and down that Hans modeled the face of Curious George after the face of his wife. Now, on the offset, you know, that might sound a little bit insulting, but it was a cute thing. And if that's indeed what he intended to do, then surely he intended it as an homage rather than some kind of weird joke.
Hey, man, monkeys are cute. I see no problem with that. And Curious George is probably the quintessential cute cartoon monkey, because some of them are like aggressive and they like throw poop at you or something. Curious George is an absolute sweetheart, and he might have gotten into some mischief, sure. But he always had the best of intentions, didn't he? He had a heart of gold, that Curious George. So, yeah, it makes perfect sense that he probably felt that the goodness of the character mimicked the goodness that shone from within his lovely wife. So they were initially going to spend a honeymoon in Paris in 1936, and they ended up staying for 4 years. heard that story before. And they were, in fact, Brazilian citizens with passports and everything. And they took up residence in the, I don't know, I'm going to get you to help me with this, Casey, the Terrace Hotel, double R, double S.
Yeah, I think it's Terrace. Yeah, Terrace Hotel.
Terrace Hotel, Casey on the case. And that would be on the Rue Joseph de Maistre. Oh, that's, yeah, guys, I butchered that one. M-A-I-S-T-R-E.
Yeah, Joseph de Maistre.
Yeah, that means the Joseph the Master. And they stayed in apartment 505. What a romantic time period. It reminds me of that movie Midnight in Paris, that Woody Allen movie, where, you know, all of the Gertrude Stein and Hemingway and all the, you know, the dead romantics. Yeah, Fitzgerald, exactly. Scott Fitzgerald come back and are kind of like
Salvador Dali
or like haunting Paris. But that era where you could take up residence in a pretty decent hotel, you know, in Paris. That sounds like a pretty cool adventure. So what happened next?
So they were living a pretty bucolic, nice existence. They wrote and illustrated children's books, but in a very lighthearted version of Heath Ledger's The Joker. It wasn't about the money. It was about sending a message. This is where Hans publishes his first children's book, this sweet story. He drew some newspaper cartoons of a giraffe. A French publisher asked him to expand on this drawing, and that's how we got Raffi and the Nine Monkeys. So he was always into monkeys as a children's author, and this eventually marks the debut of the breakout character that we know today as Curious George. After they published Raffi and the Nine Monkeys, they decided that George needed a book all his own. So they started working on this. And they said, you know, let's just describe him as curious. Let's make it part of his name. But as you know, historians, during the late 1930s and the 40s, things were very tense in Europe. And before their manuscript, what would become the Curious George book, before it could be published, the Rays, because they both were of German-Jewish extraction, found themselves in a terrible situation. The Nazi party was tearing through Europe, and they had a laser focus on France. They were, in fact, going to take Paris, as far as people at the time could tell. And they were already starting to get uncomfortable because, you know, news of the war is sort of on the distant horizon and it's getting closer and closer and closer. So to be safe, they flee their apartment in Paris and they go to a chateau in the countryside. This is cool. It's an old castle owned by some friends of theirs. We have a letter from Hans where he said, quote, "It feels ridiculous to be thinking about children's books, but life goes on. The editors edit, the artists draw, even during wartime, and then things start to go south."
Yeah, it's that kind of situation you see, and I think there's a German film about this period called The Lives of Others, I want to say, where people are being like informed upon by, you know, it's like total 1984 type material where even like people's kids are informing on their parents and, you know, horrible stuff like that. And there's like surveillance going on. And, you know, there's just this air of suspicion that's just like taking, you know, the city by storm. And there are some suspicious villagers that report this very strange couple with the strange German accents, gasp, living in this old castle, and they're reported to the Gestapo.
Yes, this is an incredibly paranoid time. Any student of history can see how quickly people will turn on one another, especially if they feel like turning on someone will help them in their own mission of self-preservation. The authorities weren't going there because they thought they were going to arrest people of Jewish heritage. They were going there because they thought they were going to discover French resistance members, you know, people with the materials and the know-how to make bombs. Hans assured the police, "Hey, me and my wife, we're just here writing children's books. Hey, check this out." I mean, they sound like the nicest people, don't they? He's like, "Hey, look at these sketches.
look at my monkey.
Do you think it looks kind of like my wife? I think it's sweet.
I think it's super sweet. Yeah, and I'm sure that the Nazis thought that too. Yeah, no, they didn't. But no, they definitely didn't get like executed summarily or anything. They were able to more or less convince the authorities that they were just writing these lovely works of children's fiction. At the time, was known as The Adventures of Fifi, which detailed the adventures and misadventures of the titular inquisitive monkey. And so they were like, oh, these guys are clearly idiots. They're not sleeper agents. No, I'm kidding. I'm trying to think, get inside the head of a Nazi. They're just so mean. They just think things like that about lovely people. But they took off, right? And the Rays were able to, you know, live to sketch and write another day. But this did prove to not be the last run-in that they had. They realized that this was not going to be a tenable situation.
Yeah, exactly. They said, you know, that was kind of a close call. How many more close calls can we expect? We have to go back to Paris. So they went back to Paris and they started trying to emigrate from France. But you can only imagine the paperwork. It's already difficult to emigrate from a country during peacetime. So this is much more difficult. And add to this the fact that more and more refugees are mobbing into the city. And all they can do is hope that they get their paperwork in line in enough time to leave before the fall of France, before the Nazis take over. And unfortunately, on May 10th, 1940, Adolf Hitler sent 3 million troops into France. People were fleeing by the thousands. The Germans, on June 14th, I believe, captured Paris.
I can't even fathom that kind of force. It makes me think of like the orcs in Lord of the Rings or something. I mean, it is just like an unstoppable like wall of humans with guns and intent on doing horrible things to incredibly innocent people. It's a terrible time to be alive. But they were very, very lucky. They were able to plot this escape that sounds like, again, like something out of a Kurt Vonnegut book. Or like some sort of steampunk adventure novel. Or have you ever seen the movie The Triplets of Belleville? Which reminds me of that kind of whimsical stuff. So good. But they were able to get some money from selling that first manuscript for The Adventures of Fifi. And the publishers gave them enough loot to fund their escape. So they were able to really squirrel that away. And they spent what would have equaled an entire month of rent on a bunch of bicycle parts that they were able to get from a bicycle shop that had sold out of actual bicycles because people were just trying to flee in any way they possibly could. And they were able to kind of, you know, ramshackle together these two sort of improvised bikes. And in their bicycle baskets, in true Parisian form, they carried bread, like probably a giant baguette, I hope, cheese and water and 5 of their manuscripts, including Fifi. And they escaped Paris in the early morning hours of June 12th of 1940, just before the Nazis captured the city.
Yep, just 2 days before. I want to emphasize that point. They did not escape with clothing. They did, you know, extra clothing. They did not escape with medical supplies. They literally had enough food to eat for some short amount of time, and their books. The first day, they rode 30 miles south. They hid in a farmhouse. Think about this. You go from living a relatively beautiful existence in an old castle. Now you're on the run in some MacGyvered bicycles, and you're sleeping in barns. They could still, from 30 miles away, hear the Germans shelling the city. The next day, they made another 20 miles. They went south again, and they slept in a barn. They continue, and they find a train on June 14th, when they're about 75 miles south of Paris, and they say, hey, if we hop this train, we can get to the Spanish border. And they were very, very lucky. As they rode the train that night, bombs fell on more and more cities behind them. And this is interesting because, okay, so Fifi, the book that we know of as the debut of Curious George, has already saved them twice, right? Once from suspicion of the local authorities, right? And then once giving them enough money to get those bike parts and escape. Fifi came through for them again, right? Because once again, somebody thought, hey, is this delightfully whimsical couple actually a pair of spies?
Yeah, once again, mental floss for the win in their breakdown of this this incredible story. One of the officers believed that they were smuggling some kind of government secrets in that dossier, you know, which obviously, as we know, just contained their manuscripts. And he insisted that they open up the folder or the briefcase, I guess is what it looked like to them, and show them what they had. And then just like the first time, monkey books, you know, that's all they are. Pretty innocuous.
I'd love to show you my sketches, officer. Tell me, who do you think this monkey looks like? Margaret, come here. Margaret, stand next to the monkey. No, you guys don't want to see it? You can read it. I love it. There's almost a Wes Anderson vibe to this escape, you know?
It's certainly serendipitous is all get out. They keep lucking out. They escape Paris 2 days before the bombing. You know, and obviously, you know, I'm sure the reality of this was a lot less charming than cobbling together bicycle pieces in some Jules Verne kind of like contraption or whatever is what I'm picturing. And then their bike baskets overflowing with breads and cheeses. And I mean, this was like under cover of dark, you know, escaping with your lives at the last minute, you know, from the jaws of horrible death. And every time you got stopped by one of these officers, you were narrowly, you were at risk of being found out and being just executed or taken to one of the camps. You know, I mean, it's just, I can't even imagine the amount of pressure they must have felt, or just the amount of like constant stress and never feeling safe and always having to keep moving, you know?
Yeah. One interesting thing too about that third close brush with arrest or discovery is that this third time, the authorities suspected them of being German spies, because we have to remember they had German accents.
Yeah, I'm surprised that they kept leaning on this notion that they were spies and not just, you know, accuse them of being Jews and just like, you know, be done with it. Because I'm sure Nazi officers have done far, far worse. But they once again escaped. They were handed back their manuscripts and sent on their merry way.
Yeah.
But once again, super narrow escape.
Mm-hmm. And then 11 days later, they arrive in Lisbon, Portugal, which I've always wanted to visit. They wait for months and months. They cross the Atlantic to Brazil, and then eventually they sail for New York City, where a friend of theirs named Grace Hogarth has just been hired as a children's book editor at Houghton Mifflin. The publishing house is still around today. And she loved the book, so she didn't just sign them on for a U.S. contract. She signed them on for a 4-book contract, and they decided to rename Fifi to George. They felt George was a little more masculine. We have also, you know, a publicity brochure from Houghton Mifflin that shows the publishers leaned into the biography of the authors. You know what I mean? They were using it as a way to sell the book. And it was all true. And I don't think it was exploitative, but it definitely helped with the debut of Curious George in the States.
Yeah, and this is powerful stuff. In June 1940, on a rainy morning before dawn, a few hours before the Nazis entered, we left Paris on bicycles with nothing but warm coats and our manuscripts, Curious George among them, tied to the baggage racks, and started pedaling south. We finally made it to Lisbon by train, having sold our bicycles to customs officials at the French-Spanish border. After a brief interlude in Rio de Janeiro, our migrations came to an end one clear, crisp October morning in 1940, when we saw the Statue of Liberty rise above the harbor of New York, and we landed in the USA. We took a small apartment in New York's Greenwich Village, rolled up our sleeves, and were ready to start from scratch. That's pretty, I mean, that's, if that's not like an immigration success story, I don't know what is. I mean, obviously, they had this dream. They knew what they had. They knew how precious those manuscripts were. They protected them with their lives, you know? I mean, they were more concern with bringing those and being careful, you know, to have them not be damaged or taken than they were about bringing more warm clothes and things like that. So really, really, it's so amazing to see when someone really knows that they're onto something. And of course, they absolutely were.
And you can confirm this first thanks to LitHub, where you can read the German Jewish refugees who created Curious George, but you can also find the gritty day-by-day meticulous notations of their escape in the collection at the University of Southern Mississippi. It's the H.A. and Margaret Ray collection. This is the basis for a book by Louise Borden called The Journey That Saved Curious George. You can also see a documentary about this journey, which was in 2017. And now, you know, we reach sort of the conclusion of today's episode. But of course, you want to know how Curious George is doing, right? This is an award-winning series. They continue to write. They had a beautiful relationship. There was a little bit of misogyny for a second, though, not on Hans's part, but they, for a time, Margaret's name was not appearing on the first, I think the first few books, because publishers thought too many women were writing children's books, so a guy's name would sell better. Tut tut.
Yikes, no good. But now we remember both of these incredible humans for not only their harrowing escape from Nazi-occupied Paris, but for the amazing work that they brought into the world. I mean, it's been made into, you know, every generation grows up with Curious George. You know, I remember I grew up in Germany, and I remember the books were huge. I read the German language versions. Then when I was a little older, there was a cartoon version. And then when my daughter was growing up, there were movies that brought Jack Johnson back into the public eye with his delightful Curious George soundtrack. So thanks to the Rays for bringing Jack Johnson back into my life.
Mm-hmm. And you'll be happy to know their legacy continues. There's 75 million copies of Curious George out there in the world. They've been sold in over a dozen languages. You know, Curious George went on to have many other close calls that were thankfully fictional. Thanks, as always, for tuning in. We hope you enjoyed this episode, and we want to hear about your favorite children's stories or young adult books. And, you know, maybe there's an interesting story behind their evolution and origin as well. Let us know. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter. You can find us on Instagram, not just as a show, but as individuals.
That's right. You can find me in my quarantine adventures or misadventures, sort of like a curious monkey, only locked in like a 3-bedroom house in Atlanta. That is at How Now Noel Brown on Instagram.
And you can find me at Ben Bolin HSW on Twitter. You can find me at Ben Bolin on Instagram. You can, you know, I'm around. You can find me somewhere on the internet. And you can also find on the internet our pal slash nemesis, the Quister, a.k.a. Jonathan Strickland, who assures us that he will be making an appearance soon. But you all, longtime listeners, know the game. He's not going to tell us when it happens. He's just going to show up and ruin the ending of a perfectly good episode.
Yeah, it's going to be one of those Zoom bombs we keep hearing so much about, you know? He's just going to come in and wreck the party. Huge thanks to super producer Casey Pegram, as always. Thanks to Alex Williams for composing our theme. Christopher Hasiotis, here in Zoom spirit.
Thanks, as always, to Roald Dahl, Shel Silverstein, Hans and Margaret Ray, and hey, Noel, thanks to you.
And you as well, Ben. We'll see you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.